You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert. The day Donald Trump won election, the single biggest movement in the stock market was in the price of a company that runs for-profit prisons. Corrections Corporation of America, which is now called CoreCivic, saw its value increase 50% in one day. And 1 month into the tenure of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the Trump administration delivered on what investors were expecting. It reversed an Obama-era policy that was phasing out the federal use of private prisons. Now, that phase-out was partly prompted by an explosive story from our next guest. As a reporter at Mother Jones, Shane Bauer took a job as a guard at the Wynn Correctional Center in Louisiana, detailing a situation where profit-driven corner-cutting was creating major health and safety problems for the inmates and for the people working there. His new book is American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. Shane Bauer, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to your decision to do the story. You had had a traumatic experience being held in solitary confinement in Iran.
Right.
What got you sending out job applications to prisons here?
Well, I spent 2 years in prison in Iran. When I got out, I came back to California, 2011. There was a massive hunger strike happening in California prisons at the time. There were reports of 30,000 people hunger striking inside prisons to protest the use of long-term solitary confinement. And I had been in solitary myself. I had also been on hunger strike. So I was kind of naturally drawn to this. I was following it, but was not really ready to get back into my work. I was still kind of adjusting to being in the free world. And but when I did go back to work, I kind of did an investigation about solitary confinement in the U.S. And that kind of pulled me deeper into the prison system, and I ended up reporting for a few years on criminal justice and prisons in the U.S. and was constantly frustrated with the lack of access to prisons, even getting basic information that we should be able to access through public records laws often required suing states or threatening to sue them to get them to comply with the law. And with private prison companies, this access is even more limited since these are companies and not, government agencies. Even public records laws don't apply. I wanted to kind of get an up-close look of what life was like inside of these prisons. We hadn't had one really since they were founded in the 1980s. So I had the idea of applying for a job as a prison guard. I filled out an application on their website. Didn't lie in the application. I put my job history, my personal information, and within a couple of weeks, I was getting phone calls for job interviews.
Describe the interview process.
It was kind of like, you know, it could have been a job interview for a Walmart. It was like, you know, they asked me how I work with others, kind of generic questions. They did not ask me why I wanted to work in a prison. They didn't ask anything about my job history. They didn't mention a single thing on my application or resume. And they were, in a way, kind of trying to sell me the job, it felt like. The HR person that I spoke to in Louisiana asked me if I liked to hunt and fish, and she told me there's great squirrel hunting in the area. She was offering a $9 an hour job, you know, and she knew that I lived in California. There was, in her mind, probably very little reason I would take such a job. But I had several offers, and I ultimately chose Louisiana, partially because Wynn happened to be the oldest medium security prison in the country, medium security private prison in the country. Louisiana at the time was also the most incarcerated, had the highest rate of incarceration on the planet. It was kind of getting into two things at once, private prisons and the state that was so highly incarcerated.
So the clear impression from the way you narrate the application process is basically, the private prison system is facing the same problem Walmart does, which is like they pay lousy, they have high turnover, so they have to constantly find people. They're not too picky about who they bring in.
Right, right. And you know, the wages are set at a corporate office in Nashville. So the actual prison is kind of having to deal with the fact that they are only offering $9 an hour. you know, it would be better for them if they were paying more because they could actually attract people. I mean, the town, Winfield, the average household income was $25,000 a year. It's a really poor area. But despite that and despite the high unemployment, they still couldn't get enough people who, you know, were willing to work for that wage in a really dangerous job. They would get, you know, kids right out of high school. I met a guy who's, this was his first job. He was 18 years old. They would get a good number of single moms, you know, who needed health insurance for their kids. Some retirees, you know, people who are supplementing their retirement income, you know, generally just people who were desperate. And there's absolutely no job requirements. In fact, in training, the head of training said to us once, if you're breathing and you have a valid driver's license and you're willing to work, then we're willing to hire you.
What's the training like?
So we had a month of training. We, you know, would kind of watch videotapes, go through these kind of very basic lessons. There were many days where we did literally nothing because there was no one there to teach us. The prison was so understaffed that the people who were supposed to teach us often had to be inside the prison. And we, you know, we would go through lessons about just kind of hypothetical situations. One on my second day of training was the instructor asked us what we should do if we see two inmates fighting. You know, this to me is the basic job of a guard is breaking up fights. And, you know, some cadets offered, you know, said we break them up or we call somebody. And he said, your job is to shout at them, stop fighting. He told us, do not get in the middle of them. He said, you know, you do not get paid enough for that. And what's important to us is we go home at the end of the day. And he said, if those fools want to cut each other, then happy cutting. And, you know, that there was kind of a, it touched on a theme that recurred a lot through training, which kind of went back to essentially the company's liability. You know, we do the bare minimum that will help protect the company in a lawsuit, like shout, stop fighting. But we don't put ourselves in situations that could cost the company money. You know, if we get in the middle of a fight, we could get injured, and that's going to cost.
How did the people you were working with react 14 months later when you published your piece in Mother Jones?
Well, a lot of them knew, actually, that I was a journalist well before that. It had kind of come out that I was a reporter after I left. So people in the prison knew, and I actually reached out to them before I published the article in Mother Jones and asked everybody who appears in the story if they wanted to do an official interview. And I did speak to some of them. There was one guy, my main work partner, Dave Bakel. He, while we were working, he said to me once, I wish an investigative reporter would come and investigate this place. So when he found out that I was a journalist, he was very excited. And the people that I spoke to, the staff members that I spoke to, were all happy that I was doing this story. I mean, they generally felt that they were also exploited by the company. It was not just the prisoners. They were, you know, overworked, put in a dangerous situation for $9 an hour. They were always complaining about how the place was run. So they were happy to see some, you know, some light shed on it.
Speaking of Shane Bauer, his new book is American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. Let's talk about the business for a minute. So obviously, CoreCivic at the time, CCA, their pitch to the state of Louisiana or the federal government, whoever they're working for, is we will lock up the same people, but we will do it for less money. Mm-hmm. And you won't have the liabilities that come with having a bunch of public employees and public records created by your incarceration. How do they do it? How do they do it cheaper?
The basic business model is state will pay, or the federal government, will pay the company a per diem rate. So in the prison I was in, the state was paying $34 per inmate per day. The companies also trade on the New York Stock Exchange, so they have investors, mostly banks and mutual funds.
So by contrast, that's about one-sixth what California spends per inmate per day.
Right. California private prisons, at least at the time I was at Wynn, were paying about $80 to private prison companies per day. And the main cost of running a prison is in staffing. So the way that private prisons do it cheaper is they pay staff less and they have less staff generally. So the guards at this prison made $9 an hour, where the starting pay at a public prison in Louisiana was $12.50, and it went up. Whereas in Wynn, I worked with guards who had been there 20 years that were making $9 an hour. They have very low numbers of guards typically. The prison I was in would have, you know, somewhere between 24, 25, 26 guards a day for 1,500 inmates. Mental health staff even was lower. There was only one part-time psychiatrist for the prison, one social worker. They tend to cut corners with medical costs. I saw a prisoner who was collapsing from chest pains, who was begging to go to the hospital that they wouldn't send. I met a man who lost his legs from gangrene, who had been going to the infirmary for months, complaining of severe pain and asking to go to the hospital, and they would just give him Motrin and send him back to his dorm. And by the company's contract, if it sends a prisoner to hospital, it has to pay for that. So it's reluctant, you know, to do that, because it's a major cost. If you're making $34 per day by an inmate, and a hospital visit is thousands of dollars, it just doesn't make sense when, you know, you're just thinking about profit.
Why don't you describe what life for inmates was like in the prison?
They lived in mostly in dorms of about 44 people. You know, each inmate would have a bed and a small locker. They would spend most of their days in those dorms. They would go out for meals three times a day to the cafeteria. Every day there was kind of a feeling of tension around whether the things that were supposed to happen were going to happen. This could be classes, you know. Classes were often getting canceled because there wasn't enough staff. This could be recreation time outside. There were many, many days that they just didn't go outside because there just wasn't staff. There were even days that the entire prison was locked down because there weren't enough, like during the holidays, there weren't enough staff because people were taking time off. So the inmates just would not leave their dorms. And so there was often this kind of daily buildup of tension that would, you know, end up exploding in some form because the prisoners would just be so frustrated, you know, that they were eating 4 hours late or they weren't going to class or whatever it was. And that, you know, just would repeat day in and day out, and it would lead to the, you know, I would be, me and the one other guard in my unit would be the people who would, you know, kind of deal with this the most, because we were their main point of contact with the prison administration. So it would, you know, I would end up getting in these kind of situations with prisoners where, you know, they were threatening me or you know, trying to somehow get out, you know, of their dorm and run off, or it was just this kind of constant dynamic of just trying to keep things under control. It was a very, very chaotic place.
Yeah. After you got out, you also tried to follow up with some of the people who'd been incarcerated there during your time at Wynn Correctional. Tell me some of their stories.
An attorney contacted me and said she had a client who was trying to find me. And I spoke to her, and she asked me if I knew a man named Damien Costley. I told her that I guarded him once. I actually guarded him on my first day on the job. I was stationed on suicide watch. This woman was Damien's mom, and she told me that he had committed suicide in the prison. I went back to Louisiana and met with her. I went to her house. She had a box of all of his belongings, a lot of paperwork, which he allowed me to go through. And I learned that Damien was in prison for shooting and killing a man. He had been racked with guilt about this, and he had told other prisoners that he was thinking of committing suicide. He sometimes was hearing voices. He went on suicide watch many times. And he also went on hunger strike many times to protest or to demand better mental health services from the company. He didn't get them, and he eventually hanged himself. And at the time that he died, he weighed 71 pounds. He was in a coma. He didn't die immediately. He was sent to the hospital. And I did a records request with the state of Louisiana asking them how many suicides had occurred in that prison that year. And they told me zero. Now, the company claims that their rate of suicide is lower than it is in public prisons. And what had happened is when Damien was sent to the hospital, the warden granted him a compassionate release, which essentially meant that when Damien died, he was not on the books of the company. He was did not die in the prison, so they didn't count it as a suicide. So they kept their records clean.
Because he went out the doors in a coma.
Yeah.
Speaking to Shane Bauer, senior reporter from Mother Jones, his new book is American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. And I want to kind of pull back the focus a little bit. You go to great lengths in this book to make the point that although private for-profit prisons are a relatively new phenomenon, using incarceration to make money is not at all new,
right,
to the American system.
So the first prisons in the country were essentially for-profit prisons. The very first penitentiary in the country was in Pennsylvania, the Walnut Street Penitentiary, and it was intended to turn a profit. The first prisons throughout the Northeast were essentially factories where prisoners were, their labor was leased to private contractors. And in the South, this was also true before the Civil War. The South actually opened penitentiaries partially as a way to help industrialize and take some of the northern monopoly on textile manufacturing and bring it to the South. The Texas's first penitentiary was the largest factory in the state. It was also the greatest producer of textiles west of the Mississippi. After the Civil War, there, you know, were many men in the South who had been making tons of money off slavery who wanted slavery to continue. And the 13th Amendment had abolished slavery except as punishment for a crime. So these men, one of them, just to give an example, Samuel Lawrence James in Louisiana, thought, you know, the state's economy is in ruins from after the Civil War. So he proposed to the state to run its whole penitentiary system. He would lease the prisoners, use them as laborers, and he would give a portion of his profits to the state. This happened throughout the South. All of the Southern penal systems were privatized. So prisoners were working on plantations, picking cotton. You know, they were being whipped. I mean, they were in this, really in exactly the same role as slaves. This man, Samuel Lawrence James, bought a plantation, put prisoners on it, you know, moved there with his family. Prisoners served him in his house. Prisoners in other states worked in coal mines. The U.S. Steel Company, the first billion-dollar company in the world, used tons of forced labor of prisoners. Prisoners who didn't meet quotas were tortured. And this system was even more deadly than slavery. Depending on the state, the average annual death rate ranged between 16 and 25%. This is on the level of the death rate of the Soviet gulags. This system went on for decades, really into the early 20th century, when states kind of decided to essentially cut out the middleman. So they bought plantations of their own and forced prisoners to work on the plantations. Often these were the same plantations that the private businessmen had been running. And they ran them at a profit, but the money was just going into state treasuries. And by the way, the convict leasing system itself was very profitable to states. Alabama at one point was making 10% of its entire state budget from leasing prisoners. But you know, so really up into the 1960s and 70s in the South, prisoners were still mostly working on labor camps for, you know, profit to the state. And it was in this system that the co-founder of CCA started his career. The man named Teraldon Hutto was the warden of a plantation in Texas called Ramsey. It was the size of Manhattan, and inmates were forced to pick cotton. He lived on the plantation. His family lived there. They had houseboys that served him and his family. And he later went on to run plantations in Arkansas at a profit to the state. And there were federal judges that were condemning what they called torture in his prisons. Inmates who refused to work in the fields were put naked in a dark cell for a month. And really around the time that he left the plantations in Arkansas, there was a major shift happening in the prison system throughout America. The population of prisons, the prison population really start booming. And states were scrambling to build more prisons to keep up. And in this context, a couple of businessmen approached Hutto and, you know, who had a record of running prisons as a business for the state. And they proposed the creation of CCA, where the company would be making money not from prison labor as they had been in the past, but the prisoners themselves would be the commodities. You know, they would be being paid just for warehousing prisoners.
Yeah. I mean, that's the really interesting contrast is you go from a almost 200-year-long legacy of using prisons as a way of organizing labor to just warehousing people.
Right.
And eking your profit margin out of billing the state more than it's costing you to run the warehouse.
Right.
Shane Bauer, I guess it leads to the question, like, you poured an immense amount of time into this. It seemed to get traction, not just with the public, but at the policy level. And now it seems back to the status quo ante, or if anything, justice is ramping up its use of private prisons. Do you feel like you made a difference?
I don't know. I mean, it's so hard to know where this country is going right now. I think, you know, people are paying attention to it more. It's getting harder and harder to justify the use of these prisons. But, you know, that doesn't mean they're going to stop using them. I think the pressure is ramping up. So it's really a state-by-state issue. But it's, you know, there's no indication that states are stopping their use of private prisons. In fact, Louisiana has been privatizing even more. And Wynn was, CCA gave up its contract with Wynn, but another company took it over. And the state's paying them much less. It's about $25 per inmate per day. So they are essentially running the prison like a jail. They're just locking people up and feeding them. There's no programs left anymore.
No recreation, no rehabilitation.
Right.
Shane Bauer, it's an amazing story. It's a super depressing story, but I'm glad you took the time to tell it. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
Shane Bauer is a senior reporter for Mother Jones. He embedded as a guard at a for-profit prison in Louisiana. His new book is American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment.